Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So just before the monks had our meal today, after all the lay people left the hall here where we eat, Ajahn Pasano made a sort of an announcement or sort of an injunction for the monastic community to be practicing with a little bit more effort maybe than we normally do. And to dedicate that merit to some friends of the community who wanted to remain anonymous to everybody else, but the monastics know, and just wanted us to really be dedicating merit to them, really putting forth a lot of effort today. We should always, but in particular for a situation that's happening, and that has sort of raised the question. And I've had it. Many times throughout the time that I've been around the monastic community and have been a Buddhist, but it's just that question of what actually happens with sharing of merit and chanting in particular. So like this evening, we did a particular chant that's supposed to be one of a really powerful chant in terms of benefits that it can provide for people, and it's a Of course, we did it in the Pali language, but it's reciting the last 28 Buddhas, and very briefly, just in sort of one line, sort of sums up the qualities of their teachings and what those teachings were, teachers were known for, and just sort of the utterance of that. Devotion, faith that we have in beings and in teachings. They say that there's a power, a benefit that comes from that. And so I was just right after the meal. I went online just to see if there was anything. I just typed in the Google search, "How do paritta chants work?" It was interesting that initially there were a couple of sites came up that I had maybe already read the things that were on there, but I didn't know it was a chat line, but I went to it, and it was kind of frustrating because you opened up and somebody had asked that question, do protective chants actually work? Do they have any benefit? And like the first 10 people that sort of responded on it, like, I don't think it does, no, it doesn't. This is all just, people's, craziness, making it up in their mind. The Buddha never taught this sort of thing. And, it's just like, it was just full of just people's opinions. And it's kind of, just sort of like, why do they even put this stuff online? And then, but somebody responded after a few posts and saying, well, actually the Buddha did actually teach protective chants even while he was alive. There's many suttas where the Buddha in various situations and in various circumstances gave instructions to people, either lay people or to monastics, to actually use particular teachings to recite various chants that would provide protections. And this person, I was very grateful to them for this website, because then he actually listed like 5 or 6 of the suttas, and so I wrote them down and spent the afternoon kind of reading through them. And then I remembered when actually Ajahn Pasano had asked us to sort of do some chanting and dedicating merit. I remembered there was this book on, it's called Legends of the Paritta, Protective Chants and the Background Stories, and it was made by Ajahn Mahapasert for commemoration of a visiting elder monk who was visiting there particular monastery, and it was just out of kind of gratitude. So they printed this book. They did a really nice job, and many of the origin stories to the Purita chants are in there, and a lot of them I had never known or had actually never even heard. So it was kind of definitely a fun read, and I'd read some of them before, and I've actually used one as a morning reflection. But a lot of these protective chants, if we're chanting them, like I'm not a Pali scholar by any stretch of the imagination, but there's oftentimes you'll hear repetitive lines, and one of them's Etena Satchava Jena Sotu Me Hotu Sabada, and that's kind of rough translation is by the power of this truth, may like all goodness come to you, or may you be protected. And oftentimes it'll come in terms of like, I take the Buddha as my refuge, I take the Buddha as my true refuge, and by the power of making this statement, may that create some sort of a protection. And one of my favorite stories in this this Purita book was the quail protective chant, and almost was in tears the first time I read it, just the simplicity of it, and just sort of I can see some really kind of deep psychological sort of deep value to this story at so many different levels. But the story is that there's this baby quail, and it's I think it's very just been born, and it's actually the Bodhisattva. So it's the Buddha has taken rebirth as this baby quail, and it's very, very young, and living in a grass field, and a forest fire breaks out, a wildfire breaks out, and it's approaching from all directions, kind of in towards the quail's nest, and the parents see the fire coming, and they get fearful, and can't protect the baby, can't really get it out of there anyway, so they flee, the parents fly away, and then the quail's reflecting that its wings aren't strong enough yet for it to fly away, and also its legs aren't strong enough yet for it to run away. And even if it could run away, there'd be no place for it to run to anyway, because the fire was completely around and sort of burning in towards the nest, and so the quail being the Bodhisattva though reflects on his faith in the Buddha, and reflects on just the qualities of the Buddha of being awake, being the, as Lumbar Samhita would say, like the one who knows. Just paying attention to what the situation is that he's in, and so the little quail takes stock of the situation. So he's like, okay, here I am, been abandoned, completely alone. There's a forest fire coming in. It looks like potential danger coming. My wings don't work. My legs don't work. And then he says, by the utterance of this truth, this is my truth. That's it. This is my truth. I'm a hopeless, helpless here. And as the power of that determination, then the fire goes out. And the reason the Buddha was telling the story was that he was actually on alms round, and the same sort of situation broke out where there was a forest fire. And there was kind of completely surrounded them. And it was about a quarter of a mile distance away from them. And then sort of the wind shifted and the fire went out. And the people, the monks that he was with, were kind of marveling, sort of projecting that onto the Buddha, saying, wow, you have really great powers that you created that stopped that fire from coming. And the Buddha said, no, that actually has nothing to do with my current existence. And then he tells the story of the baby quail, and he said it was the continuation from the Bodhisattva from rebirth to rebirth, and it was still that the strength of that being present in the moment, really understanding his situation and just declaring that as a truth, you know, many lifetimes later, it's like it was still having some sort of karmic effect of protecting the Buddha. And so I look at this story as, really learning to, not so much being afraid of our situation. You know, our situation actually rarely is what we want it to be. Like every morning this week, just sort of, coming down for doing our morning chores, or I was on the forest practice, so I wasn't here for the morning pujas, but just coming down, just having that long period of not eating, feeling a little bit weak and putting forth effort when you haven't eaten. It just, for whatever reason, every morning I came down, just felt a little sick, just, kind of wheezy or not feeling good. But I was just always reflecting, well, this is just the way it is. You know, it's like I was actually sort of contemplating, like, if I wasn't being aware of this, I would think that there's something wrong, or I would be, fantasizing about, oh, when I was 20, I was in perfect health, and I wish it could be that way again. But actually just even using a little bit of, common sense and wisdom, when I look back to when I was 20, I think I was always in pain when I was in 20 as well. There's this, projection, we can kind of think back about a time when, things were better. And I think oftentimes we're actually just creating that as a, not necessarily as a fantasy, but it, probably 99% sure most of the times when we think about the past, we kind of romanticize it, we can, gloss over the edges, smooth out the story, and it actually never was as good as we thought it was. So I had that feeling, and if I live to be 80 and I'm still have the strength to be able to walk down that same trail, I'll be thinking back, gosh, when I was 50, I was feeling so much better than I am now. But kind of remember that, no, I wasn't. So this declaration of truth, of just being able to, just see that in the moment, like, okay, yeah, this is the way it is. There's this particular feeling, there's this these sensations going through, even the storytelling. It's like when the mind starts telling stories, it's like that has been conditioned as well. So everything about that story has been sort of planted in there from all the actions that I've done in the past. And so I like telling a story when I was first here. There was actually a couple people that I was always kind of annoyed with and aggravated with, and probably because they had very similar personalities to myself, and they were when they were physically manifest in them, it was sort of difficult for me to see, because I knew I had those same qualities. And so it was people that were kind of averse type of personalities. And I would always think, like, they shouldn't be that way. They shouldn't be this way. And I kind of get upset. One day it just hit me. It's like, they actually, if they could be different, they would be. I could see that they were in pain when they were, in those aversive states, and are doing things that were unskillful, or, raising their voice, or, bossing people around. I could see that they were actually, in pain in doing that. And, all of us, nobody wants to be in pain, so I realized, like, wow, they are just, kind of blindly, following how they've been conditioned. It's like if their life had been different in their past. And one of them had, pretty traumatic past, where a lot of abuse and just living in very difficult situations. And it just dawned on me. It's like, oh, they are actually acting perfectly to how they've conditioned themselves to react. Like, they actually couldn't really react differently. Or, at least the mind states that would come up to them. I think, you know, that's definitely for sure. It's like, you know, when a situation arises, their mind state, their mental conditions that come up, that's like, you know, it's almost predetermined, because it's like that's how they've lived their life, and that is what's going to come up. But what comes up with the baby quail protection is that, you know, when we do reflect, you know, it's because the little bird, instead of, you know, just jumping in with the, you know, panicking or getting really angry or sorrowful or, you know, however we could react, just he started reflecting on his situation. You know, first thing that came to his mind was the having faith in the Buddha. You know, that came to his mind, the very first thing, and then, you know, just taking stock of the situation. So, you know, like the situation with the monks that I was being judgmental about. You know, it's like if they had been, you know, in whatever situation or whatever caused those situations to arise and them to act that way. You know, the moment before that was all 100% natural, but it would be, considering that you know, not being in the moment of, you know, reflecting, if not actually paying attention to what the situation is, not paying attention to what the mental state was, but just blindly reacting to it, that's what caused the outward expression of the anger or of the, you know, their frustration. And so you know, looking at that now internally, you know, it's really easy to see the defilements in other people, to see that, you know, rising in somebody else, and to have judgments and opinions or views. It should be this way, it shouldn't be that way. And so, but the practice goes, you know, even deeper when, you know, we can see those things arise, but you know, to see them arising in ourselves, see our own, you know, views and opinions. So, like, you know, now it's like if I saw somebody doing something unskillful, and, you know, might see feel the pain in that. Well, the pain that's in that is in me. You know, so it's the next thing is to, you know, just turn the practice into, you know, paying attention to what is my reaction to the situation. What are my views? What are my opinions? You know, like, even and start to questioning them. You know, that's part of reflection, is learning to ask, say, skillful questions, and just, you know, turning it on, like, well, why do I have that opinion? Like, you know, why should that person acting that way, why should that bring up anger in me, or why should that bring up aversion, or why do I, you know, how did that perception come that it shouldn't even, you know, be that way? You know, sometimes it's not even important really to have the answer to arise. You know, like, oh, it's because of, you know, this is the way my father did it, or, you know, like, you can get some good insights into that and say, like, okay, I can see how it's conditioned. But part of the reflection or asking those questions is just asking the question can actually prevent you from going into the story, can at least the emotion and acting it out. It's sort of like you get a slightly different perspective. You're adding a different viewpoint to that situation. With these, you know, protective chants, say a lot of them do have that particular phrase, or it might be phrased in slightly different ways, but it's, yeah, just, you know, by the utterance of this truth, you know, may that provide a protection. And so, you know, one protection is obvious, that if we're really trying to be in the moment and just noticing, you know, what is the feeling that's arising, what is our natural tendency to react, you know, when we can really state that clearly, just even in our minds, you know, okay, this is where I'm at. You know, the protection is that then we don't get spun out, we don't, you know, start following a negative state of mind. And I think in many ways it's like, you know, many times, like when we need a protective chant, or when we need some comfort, or just that safety, you know, to be present and to not get lost in the story, then our, you know, our mindfulness, our energy can be there fully for, well, what's actually, you know, looking at it in terms of skillfulness. So there's, you know, the just getting lost in the story and reacting is would be like, you know, akusala, you know, like an unwholesome, unskillful behavior oftentimes. But if we can catch it and just, you know, note that, okay, this is really where we are with this, then we can turn to you know, wholesome thoughts or responses to it, to, you know, go in the opposite direction of what would be, like, we would know would be an unskillful or unwholesome way of dealing with it, or just even not even having to do anything to the situation, but just not to let it proliferate into almost like a, you know, wasted energy, but just to learn to become just present for that particular moment. You know, I do, you know, recognize with the, you know, like the question of you know, how do these, you know, protective chants or the, you know, dedication of merit work? You know, I've just over the years that I've been practicing, you know, I've mentioned several times the, you know, the stories of doing loving kindness practice, of metta practice, where you know, one really dramatic, you know, situation I had is actually, you know, just paying attention to the practice and seeing the results. You know, over a certain period of time, you can just sort of develop this confidence that, you know, these you know, that particular type of practice does work. And you know, so the example I always use with the metta practice is that I was living in an ashram, and a friend of mine was developing something like Reiki therapy. This, the ashram, there are a lot of people doing very experimental types yoga practices, and this man was doing something, and I've been letting him do some sessions with me over a period of time, and I never felt anything. I would always just sort of, you know, laying down on this table, and he was doing his energy work and never felt a thing. And then that particular day, though, my grandmother was getting ready to go in for surgery for cancer, and I must have been thinking about her most of the day and sending her, you know, thoughts of kindness, and we started doing the session, and all of a sudden I just sort of felt this sort of warm glow of energy just in front of my chest. And the man had told me, he said, you know, if I ever feel anything, to let him know. And so I said, well, you know, I'm actually feeling this, you know, white ball of energy. And he said, that's healing energy. He says, you can send that to people. So I was like, okay, well, you know, grandma's having the surgery tomorrow, and I bet she's, you know, even right now, she's probably nervous about this and upset. So I'll start sending it to her. So I just, you know, actually had this vision of that energy, you know, flowing to her. And I actually felt like there was this energy moving. And then just doing that for a few minutes, and that felt really good. And then I thought, you know, my mother and my uncles, they're probably nervous about this operation as well, so I'll send it to them. So I started, you know, bringing them into my consciousness and sending the energy to them. And I really felt like the energy was flowing again. I could, you know, I could actually even get a sense of that. And then without thinking about it, I said, and then to their children as well, meaning my brother and sister and my cousins, but that was me as well. So my mother's children, that was me. And as soon as I said that, it was as if I was like, the way I describe it was like I was standing next to a railroad track, like 2 or 3 feet off to the side, and a train comes by at like 60 miles an hour. It was just this, you know, real strong, powerful energy. And I actually started, you know, like an epileptic seizure, just sort of bouncing off the table. And you know, and this guy who's doing the energy work, he was, my joke is he said, you know, continue to breathe. And I think he was talking to himself, you know, remember to breathe, you know. And then after a few minutes, that experience, you know, subsided, and then he put a blanket on me or something and said, you know, okay, okay, we'll end the session. And then after I, you know, recovered, because it took a few minutes, you know, maybe even longer, to kind of recover from that, and he was like, you know, he said, if you want to talk about it, you know, like, what happened there? And then I just started, you know, recalling what I was doing. Then it, you know, dawned on me. It's like, oh, when I was, you know, to their children, that being me, it's like I really did get the sense that that was the returning of that, you know, particular, you know, sending out the loving kindness, and that was, you know, returning. And you know, I don't feel like my siblings have never, you know, told me that they were driving down the highway and they got this epileptic seizure, but you know, so somehow, you know, maybe it was the proximity, I was closer to the source or whatever, that it you know, affected me that way. I have no idea, you know, try to figure it out, but that just did give me this real strong sense that you know, these types of practices actually do have some sort of very physical, very real effect. And then the other one I had with loving kindness was I tell this occasionally, was I was sitting a loving kindness retreat, and I really wanted to be sending loving kindness to my father for various reasons, and I won't get into it, but it was health related. And it was a 3-week retreat, and I really, really connected very strongly with sending loving kindness to my dad about day 5 of this retreat. And yeah, just had a something shifted in my kind of understanding about our relationship, and let go of some attachments that I had, and was able just to really purely wish him well. And and so this loving kindness is flowing really smoothly for him, towards him. And then at the end of the retreat, there was a letter. This is back when people still used to write letters and put them in the mail. And I read it, and my father had sort of opened up to me about some situations that were happening in his life. And he actually sort of, I was considering like ordaining, and he actually, in the letter, sort of gave his blessings for that, which he hadn't really been open to it before. I was really struck by this, and I looked at the date. I was like intrigued, like, when did he write this? And he wrote the letter the day after I started sending him loving kindness. And it's also significant in the fact that I'd never received a letter from my father before in my life. So it was like the first time he'd ever written me a letter, and it was this really long, sort of heartfelt letter. And it, you know, came the day after I started, you know, sending him this loving kindness. So just from, you know, experiences like that, you know, you could, you know, from a scientific rationalist perspective, look at it and say, oh, these things are just chance, or you did have an epileptic seizure, you know, and has nothing to do with loving kindness. And it actually may be correct. You know, I'm not saying that you know, I know the answers, but, you know, over the years, you know, been here as a monk for, we've been in the community for about 17 years, and, you know, how many times, you know, we've done morning chanting, you know, for somebody who's going to have surgery, and, you know, we get the news back that, you know, the doctor, right before they did the surgery, realized they didn't have to do it, or, you know, or the surgery went extremely well, or, you know. I'm sure there's been cases where we've done the chanting and nothing's actually happened, but almost a lot of people, you know, do report back to us that, you know, they did feel, you know, really calm going into the operation, or you know, situations, you know, did affect them. Like very recently, we had a close friend that had been, you know, quite ill for quite a long time, and he requested that we do the chanting. We did the same chant that we did for him tonight. And he wrote to us about a couple months ago and said that he was really appreciative of it. And so we just did the chanting for him again, like the right after that. And we hadn't seen him here for like almost a year, and he's all of a sudden started showing up again. So, you know, it's like, it's not good to think of these as, you know, like, oh, this will definitely cure me, or... I do think they do have a power in sort of in you know, whatever way that you know, if it doesn't, say, you know, cure the illness or the disease, but it could, you know, bring, you know, very strong mental clarity, or be able to, because like a lot of the chants, it doesn't actually say that, you know, it will cure all of the, you know, the physical ailments, because, you know, all of us are, you know, surprise, surprise, all of us are going to die at some point. And so, you know, even the Buddha himself, you know, wasn't only lived to the age of 80. That surprisingly now seems quite young to me, but so even the Buddha, with all of his strengths and the power of his mind, you know, just lived to the age of 80. But more importantly is that mental clarity, the mental, not having to go into the stories, into the the negative aspects of that, and those are natural occurrences that come up into the mind. But the power would be then to see that for what it is, to acknowledge that it's there. But then also, having the strength and the knowledge that, okay, we don't have to go there. You know, like what's a positive way to move forward with this? Another aspect of these chantings, where it's saying I take the Buddha as my refuge, and then making that as a declaration, and asking that. Having that declaration, be of power. One of the things that was mentioned in a lot of these is that of the Buddha, when he was going after when the Bodhisattva made the determination to become a Buddha, and all the countless lifetimes that he went through after making that determination to be a Buddha, all the Jataka tales. I think it's been said that like of all the precepts that you can break, and of many of the unskillful qualities that you can do, the Buddha, the Bodhisattva, he sort of broke all of the he killed people, he stole from things, but the one thing that he didn't break in all of those lifetimes was the saccha, pardon me, the truthfulness. So his speech was, he never, what's different than the sila, I guess, Kachin Kurnadamo gave a talk about this recently, which I haven't heard, so I don't know what he actually talks about in that, but it's more of this truthfulness. And so they say that, because the Buddha actually had, perfected that one barnami, way stronger than all of the others, and it was one that he just, would not bend on, that that when you, just make that, determination about the Buddha, just the, when we make these sort of statements, by the the power of this truth, may that provide a protection, that just the strength of the Buddha's awakening, and all the countless lifetimes that he perfected that truthfulness of that it still has this sort of residual strength to it. And I often reflect on this, that we can think, well, the Buddha's passed away. There's, there's the teachings, available, and we can, we hear stories of people becoming enlightened, from having put the practice, into their daily lives. But I had this realization one day that it's like, I was walking on alms round wearing the Buddhist robes and having the alms bowl and the shaved head, and somebody just spontaneously came up and put some food in the alms bowl, and just all of that just sort of clicked together, and I was just like, this immense sense of gratitude for the Buddha just came into my mind. It was just the realization that, just thinking about it, is that when he was still the Bodhisattva, think about 3 days before he actually became enlightened, or the day before he became enlightened, what if he just came up with the thought of, this isn't possible, I'm going to give up, I'm going to go have a milkshake, or I'm going to go get some Gatorade up at the MUB, it's easier to do that. If he had not put forth that effort on that last night, And then, but the fact that he did, you know, put forth the effort, and the fact that he did, you know, realize, enlightenment, that here we are 2,600 years later, and, we don't know exactly if this is the exact, color of robes and the exact style of how he wore it, but the fact that, you know, the teachings have survived, the fact that, the alms round exists, the fact that, provides the opportunity for people to be generous, and, just everything about that receiving of that alms food on that particular day, I just saw really clearly that was a direct result of the Buddha having become enlightened. And, so if you can see the connection there, see the power of that one insight that the Buddha had, still having very physical, ramifications 2,600 years later, the countless lifetimes of, perfecting that Saccha Parami, I can imagine that has, is going to have some residual effect. And so I like the fact that this chant, is actually very clearly, kind of states that, it's like, really bringing up into our consciousness. So like tonight, for the people Lumpur asked us to, dedicate our practice to, to just kind of reflect on, like, what does the, saying I take refuge in the Buddha, what does that really mean to us? Why did we decide to become monks, or why did we decide to visit the monastery? Why did we want to be here as a guest? What was the causes and conditions? What faith do we have in the Buddha's teachings? What faith do we have in the Dhamma that keeps us here? If we do live here, if we lived here for 5 years or 10 years or 15 or 40 years, what is that faith that we have that keeps us here, that draws us here? What's the, what does it mean, the Sangha, to us? So to, again, just the power of that, bringing it into consciousness, really thinking about that, particularly tonight, really asking yourself that question, what does the Buddha mean to us? That's a question that each of us has to answer for ourselves. But then, really just consciously bring that in. Maybe it is, we still have questions about what the Buddha means to us, but just that, having that knowledge of that, and then just really consciously think, okay, this is the truth of my situation. This is where the, why I'm here. This is what I'm trying to understand, or this is what I have been practicing, or this is what's of value to me. And then just, just dedicating that to anybody we know who's in, in a situation of needing some protection, needing some comfort, needing some direction. Yeah, and just learning to see the power of the silence too. And just dedicating any goodness that comes from our practice to anybody that's in need, all beings. So I'll leave that for our reflection this evening.
Om namah dhamma kataya sarukaram pradamase
sadhu.